Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you. Tonight, the phone lines are open, and if you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, use that number from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream and joining us, 877-941-3689 is the number to use. Now, for most of the past 10 days, Hawaii's legislature has been in a special session to debate whether Hawaii will be the next state to approve marriage equality. Tonight, it would seem they are poised to do just that. Seem, though, is the operative word. The Senate still has to agree to the House amendments. In advance of the session and throughout it, we've had several conversations on the morning show, and this evening we'll continue with a panel of attorneys to look at what might happen should the bill pass. Whatever the outcome, though, there will be deep rifts in the community and the work left to do to help it heal. Tonight on Town Square, a look at the path forward should Hawaii be the 16th state to approve same-sex marriage. And again, if you'd like to join us, you can, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight, joining me, Vanessa Chong, the Executive Director of the ACLU of Hawaii. The ACLU has been advocating the passage of the Marriage Equality Bill, SB1. Also here is Blake Oshiro, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Abercrombie and the former representative for District 33. In 2011, he was instrumental in passing the Civil Unions Bill. And to round out our table, Professor Carol Peterson, who teaches at the UH Law School and is the director of the Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution. She specializes in legal issues involving gender, human rights, the right to equality in international and domestic law, and the use of mediation to resolve complaints of discrimination. Thank you all for being here.
Aloha. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Now, here we are in pretty much the bottom of the second week in a session that was supposed to be ostensibly a week. But, you know, given this, did any of you actually think we were going to get through in a week?
I actually thought there was a possibility. But once the testimony really started rolling in, we saw that actually it was going to take quite a long time.
Especially with those House hearings so late in the week.
Yeah, when they have a hearing that goes 57 hours, that is unprecedented. And so it really was an opportunity for both sides to come forward and have their voices heard. And so it really was an unprecedented hearing ever in the state of Hawaii.
How would you each characterize what you've heard so far? As I know all of you have been down there and listening, How do you characterize this go-round with the same issue that we've been dealing with for such a long time now?
Well, Vanessa? I think it's undisputed that everyone has had a chance to express their viewpoint on this issue. So Hawaii, more than possibly other states, and given the diversity of our community, have had many voices now expressing their views about the issue. We know how the legislative process works, and it's working as it should. Everybody's getting a chance to voice their opinion, and now we are looking to our lawmakers to exercise their obligations and their duties and make a decision in the best interests of Hawaii. And so all sides of the issue, we know, are working lawmakers this week and continuing to make the case. And supporters of marriage equality are not taking any of the nooks and crannies that the legislative process involves for granted. So we are cautiously optimistic, and we're just working it as fully as we can.
Carol?
Well, I'm also cautiously optimistic that the bill will pass, and I'm cautiously optimistic that it will pass in a way that will allow the diverse communities to come together and resolve their conflicts. Although in one sense, yes, I do support the legislature for being so open and patient, listening to all the testimony. On the other hand, I think it's worth noting that a good deal of the testimony was somewhat irrelevant to the key point. And I think it does indicate that quite a few people who came in may not fully understand the relationship between religious views and law.
I mean, quoting the Lord's Prayer or singing or any of that is not really testimony?
No, it's really not. And, I mean, Hawaii is probably the only state in the United States that would allow that kind of testimony to come in. I think the legislature was being very patient and making sure that everyone's voice was heard. But I think it would be useful if the community had some, at some point, some discussion about what the First Amendment really involves. Yes, everyone has an absolute right to their religious beliefs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have a right to ask the legal system to compel other people to follow your beliefs. And that's really what I was hearing quite a bit of. I listened to a lot of the testimony before the House committees, and it seems that a lot of people do think that their religious freedom includes a right to impose their religious beliefs through the legal system. And I think it's important that the legislature clarify that, that that's not why they're listening to people's testimony about their religious beliefs. They can listen to it for the purposes of considering the scope of any religious exemptions, perhaps, but not for the basic principle on whether or not people should have a right to marry.
Blake O'Shea, you are an attorney, and were practicing before you entered public service. What do you think of what Carol just said, that somehow we don't really do a good job of letting people know what's appropriate testimony?
Well, I think that, you know, I do recognize what she's saying, especially when you hear the repetition that occurred. And even as you cited, I think some people saying the Lord's Prayer or singing. But, you know, the legislative process is meant to be open to the public. And it really is a First Amendment right to petition your government. And so it's on a very controversial issue like this, it's very hard to create limitations. And what you saw, I think, was a reaction when the Senate had their hearing and then they created some limitations, that there was an immediate sort of uproar. And whether that was sincere or not, it became a attack for the next round to say that, well, those guys didn't listen, so I'm hoping you guys will listen. And so that is in some ways why I think the House almost bent over backwards in order to give everybody an opportunity. Out of the 5,184, you got two chances to actually testify, which almost never happens in the legislative process. Usually your bill comes up, you're there. If you're not there, too bad, we're moving on. And so the fact that that's how they decided to handle it, I think, really was a unique way of trying to demonstrate an openness, because they recognize that this was such a controversial issue.
So better to be a little bit more generous and err on that side.
I think that was the thinking of the House when they decided to go through this marathon hearing process.
But here we are, and we sort of, it's at the point now where you can look back at some of it and say, was it a good thing? Was it worth it?
Well, I think actually, you know, I think it was worth it, so that, you know, there's this argument that we need more time, that this really was a rushed session. And if you see anything else, it really wasn't a rushed session. And you really don't need more time, because actually there was 57 hours of people being the opportunity to testify. And so this really is an issue that's time for people to just have a right to have their voice, and then for the legislature to make their decision. And there's no reason for any further delay, because a lot of your listeners already know this issue started in 1993 with Bear versus Lewin. We were the ones that actually, when you look at the federal history in terms of the Defense of Marriage Act, they cite to Hawaii and say, that's why we had to pass DOMA. And now that DOMA is finally defeated, it's coming full circle, and Hawaii is hopefully, maybe the 16th state, ready to say we're ready for same-sex marriage again.
When Justice Levinson joined us earlier in the week, he was very optimistic that this was it, that I think, Carol, as you said when we talked to you last week, that the train is a-coming, and at some point to realize that it's better to help craft now than to wait and have to simply be in reactionary mode later, perhaps. But that's a very hard sell for someone who believes in his or her bones that this is absolutely wrong. And Carol, when you were here last week and we were talking about it, how those exemptions would be expanded, at that point, we didn't really know exactly. There was some conversation about it. Are you happy with the exemptions?
The exemptions that have been added as amendments by the House are a little broader than I would have suggested, but I certainly think that we can live with them. And they're very similar to what was adopted in Connecticut. Connecticut has broader exemptions than a number of the other states. And to that extent, I think that those who opposed the bill and went to testify should feel that they were heard, because there's no question that I think many members of the House opted for broader exemptions because of the impassioned testimony that they heard. And that was the point I was trying to make earlier. It's really only to the issue of religious exemptions that kind of testimony is relevant, right? But I think you're right. The train is coming. I mean, even before Illinois passed its bill, I think I read that 1/3 of the population in the United States is now living in states where same-sex marriage has been legalized. With Illinois coming in, I mean, it's moving rather quickly. So I think that Hawaii should be at the beginning rather than the end, I hope. And I hope that those who oppose the bill can look back at other changes that have been made in the legal system and realize that they've adjusted to that. I mean, for example, the Catholic Church prohibits divorce. If a Catholic is married in the Catholic Church and then gets a civil divorce without getting permission and annulment from the Catholic Church won't recognize her next marriage, right? She'll be considered to be living in adultery even though she's received a divorce in the civil system and remarried in the civil system. The Catholic Church has learned how to deal with that, right? They have learned to respect the fact that not all Catholic canon law is going to be implemented through the legal system. That's why we have access to birth control. Right?
But once upon a time that was. I mean, once upon it was reflected
exactly.
Or mirrored in law, and that became part of the issue as it slowly began to pull apart, which some would say is evidence of, you know, a culture falling apart.
Well, some people might say that, but there were a lot of religious leaders down there at the Capitol testifying in favor of marriage equality. So it's not as though it's a divide between the religious community and the non-religious community. It's actually a divide among different religious faiths. And that's exactly where the government should not be getting involved and saying, oh, we're going to enforce the views of this religious group over the views of that religious group. I mean, that would be a complete violation of the First Amendment.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about the same-sex marriage bill. What will happen with marriage equality right now? It's still hanging in the balance. We won't really know until it's over. But looking at what may happen as we go forward, whatever happens, there will be some very deep wounds that are going to have to get healed. How do we do that as a community? How do we do that and preserve the rule of law, whatever it may be? We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight, my guests are Professor Carol Peterson. Just heard her speak a moment ago from the Matsunaga Institute for Peace. Also, Vanessa Chong is here, head of the ACLU, and Blake Oshiro, deputy chief of staff. Sorry. I was going to call you something else
because you've had several titles.
If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. But Carol, what you were just talking about a moment ago with how we began to see this separation of canon law and secular law, that also is part of an argument about the separation of church and state and what people do or don't understand about it. Do we need to do generally a better job of explicitly talking about what that means, Vanessa?
Well, this issue does give Hawaii a historic opportunity to take next steps once we complete the legislative process. And I like the idea of creating open spaces within our communities, whether it's within the religious environment or community organizing or other community spaces, a chance for people to process this experience and figure out how we work together again. Because we're an island state, there are pluses and minuses to that. And having grown up here, I think mostly pluses, which is why I'm still living in Hawaii, and that Hawaii will find a way to bridge the gap and we'll start talking to each other again in a more respectful manner and move on. I think what will happen when Hawaii welcomes marriage equality is that the sky will not fall. Families, as we speak, are continuing to struggle and find work or are working, taking their kids to school, worrying about what to do with their kupuna, all the similar problems we all face. That doesn't change. But what does change significantly is that all ohana now are at the same table. And that's why labor has come out in many labor organizations have come out in support of marriage equality, because part of their mission is to provide good working environments for their members and to give all of their members an equal opportunity to build a sustainable life and keep our talent living and working in Hawaii.
Blake, as we talk about healing rifts, and as Vanessa and Carol have said, we're not just talking about pro versus con, but we're also talking about within religious communities, within secular communities. How do we start to begin to do some of the things that Vanessa just talked about, creating those open spaces?
I think people really need to have just a lot more honest conversations about how you achieve the balance between religious freedom and at the same time actually protecting the rights of individuals when it comes to civil liberties and civil rights. And so, you know, this to me was a really good example that when you heard from testifiers, what you often heard was, you know, how dare this bill try to intrude on my freedom of religion? And actually, it doesn't really do any of that. I mean, as long as you are in your private space, if you're in your house of worship, your place of worship, there is no intrusion at all in terms of a compelling to recognize or do anything to force you to have a ceremony or a reception in your place if it's a private place. However, what the balance is that when you intrude into the public accommodations area, when you are a business, when you're actually in the free market, then at that point we do have restrictions because we recognize that there shouldn't be discrimination, whether it's on race or whether it's on age or whether it's on ethnicity. And so another category that we've deemed to be protected as consistent with our equal rights and equal protection is sexual orientation and gender. And so that is why this bill fits into that sort of concept of the balance between your ability to exercise freedom of religion, but at the same time, not intruding too much into public accommodations and the need to prohibit discrimination.
And we saw that happen today on a national level.
Yes, we did. We did in the Senate when they actually, the Senate finally kind of moved forward, although I don't know how it's going to go in the House, but they passed the ENDA Act.
It is historic. Yeah, that's the first time in the federal legislature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which sort of lends even more credence to the fact that we're moving in a very different direction than we were even 10 years ago or 5 years ago. We've got callers on the line. If you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going first to Sean calling us from Waikoloa. Aloha, Sean. Thanks for your patience.
Hey, no problem. Hi. First off, just want to say that for me personally, I am a fairly conservative Christian, but I do have some fairly liberal views. And for me personally, you know, I've got no issues at all with, same-sex marriage. Personally, I believe that, you know, two mature adults who love each other have every right to live together and have a family and have the benefits that, you know, straight couples have. So honestly, I have no issue whatsoever with that. And I think that, you know, it is more of a legal issue than it is any kind of religious issue because one religion has no power over another religion as far as what they recognize as marriage. But my only real concern in this whole matter is the fact that, you know, every time this has come up in the past, the people of Hawaii who, you know, let's face it, it is a very liberal state politically, very Democrat. Of all the places I've lived, I've never seen a place where it's more accepting of people of alternative lifestyles than here. You know, family members are proud of people that are transgender, gay, lesbian. You know, so obviously, as a whole, the citizenry here is very supportive. But whenever it's gone to the polls, the same citizens have voted down same-sex marriage. And so it would seem apparent that although the citizens of Hawaii do support, homosexuals and gay, lesbian, transgender, they still hold marriage to be traditionally a man and a woman. So when something like that is going to the legislation to make decisions on, doesn't that sort of say now that basically our government is saying that they know better than the citizens do on these kind of issues? And what doors does that open in the future for, you know, other bills that could be passed that perhaps the majority of citizens are against, but the legislature decides we're going to do it anyway. We don't care if you don't like it.
Right. I mean, we had somebody write in and say, well, doesn't this open the door to polygamy or whatever else you want to insert into that phrase. Let's go right around the table and try to answer his question. First, Carol Peterson, go ahead.
Thank you. I think the first point I'd like to make is that majority rule is a tricky thing when it comes to the rights of a minority. And in the newspaper today, someone quoted from the Loving v. Virginia case, a very accurate quote, stating that the trial judge, when the trial court convicted Mr. and Mrs. Loving for being in an interracial marriage, he quoted from his interpretation of the Bible, right? He felt that this was legitimate because God intended the races to stay separate. Thankfully, the U.S. Supreme Court did not agree, and they struck down Virginia's ban on interracial marriage. But if we had put that to the polls at the time, the majority of Americans did not support interracial marriage at that time. And so if we are going to throw out the rights of a minority to the majority, you really have to be very, very careful about that. This isn't just an issue of public policy. It's an issue of equal rights. And the other thing I would just like to add is that, of course, the electorate does have recourse. If they're very unhappy with what the legislature has done, they can vote them out when the next election comes around. And I don't think that that will happen. And one of the reasons I don't think it will happen is that, you know, as Vanessa pointed out, is the sky going to fall in a year or two? I don't think so. And one reason I don't think so is that civil unions has not actually caused any great problems in Hawaii, as far as I can tell. And under state law, civil unions give same-sex couples the same rights as marriage. It's only under federal law that they're suffering discrimination right now. So that makes me think that a lot of the people who are very, very upset, and we don't know whether it's a majority or not, but the people who are very upset about it may not fully understand that in state law, there actually isn't going to be a change. They have the same rights they have under civil unions. The only difference is the word marriage. And one of the legislators said, wouldn't it be nice if we could call it something different?
Well, my kid, when he was a little kid and we were going through some of this with the civil union, said, well, why don't you just call it something else? And then the flip side is, well, why should someone have to call it something else if that's what it is?
Right. Well, and under federal law, you need to call it marriage, right?
Right?
At one point, I thought perhaps you could draft a bill with some opening language that makes it clear that we're not trying to regulate religious marriage. We're just trying to regulate civil marriage. And in many countries, they do have this very clear distinction between religious marriage and civil marriage.
And why sometimes you have to get married twice if you want to have both.
Exactly. Exactly. But I honestly think that the majority is going to find that in Hawaii, not much has really changed. What will have changed is that our same-sex couples will now have equal rights in federal law as well.
Vanessa, she's sort of making the point that this is, in a way, a tempest in a teapot that's so stirred up right now in this moment in time. But then as the moments move on, in the same way we moved on from civil unions, that it will settle into some of those things that you talked about a little earlier in the conversation, where people get back to their lives and what they do anyway, and it's not going to be top of mind. Unless someone wants to make it top of mind. Do you see that there's going to be an agenda to do that?
Well, there's always going to be some individuals who will not be happy about marriage equality ever, and they will continue to express their views. And that's the beauty of living in a free society, is that there are spaces for them to do that. And lawmakers can respond if they are so moved. And by the way, I think the House lawmakers who came forward and supported marriage equality are to be commended. I mean, one of the unique aspects of having a constitution and a Bill of Rights is that the Bill of Rights essentially puts brake on majority or mob rule. Mm-hmm. Just because there are more people in the room that decide, nah, we don't want you to be in the room with us, doesn't mean they get to do that. And that's why fundamental rights were so precious. We codified them separately. And they're commonly referred to as the Bill of Rights, and that's what we cherish and hold to. But you can see in a situation like this, apparent to the ACLU anyway, is that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what it means to have a fundamental right in our free society, and that even though you belong to the majority, even if the lawmakers themselves felt they were in the majority to suppress a minority, you can't do that under the Constitution, and for good reason. Because we never know when we're going to be part of the minority. And all we have to do is look back in Hawaii history for a number of very visible experiences we've had where we've firsthand experienced a touch of discrimination and how it impacted our community. So I think very favorably of Hawaii, and we will move on.
Give you a chance to answer the same question, Blake.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree with what Professor and Vanessa have said. I think, you know, just to the caller's observation about how when you look at Hawaii and you think that everybody's very accepting, I think a lot of that comes just from the historical and cultural upbringing that we have of the diversity, right? There's really a lot of diverse mix of cultures and just, you know, even just when you go to eat a meal, I mean, it's a mixed mishmash of all kinds of different type of ethnicities. And so, you know, that idea of acceptance and diversity is just kind of ingrained, I think, in our community. But ultimately, when you come down to the question of how can we dictate things by poll and whether it just should be a majority rule, that's really not consistent with the idea of representative democracy. And that is the core of what we have. And the idea there is, you know, there is a responsibility that people as elected officials have in terms of looking at what is the best interest of the overall issue before them, and they need to balance that. Because if you ultimately were to just ask the populace all the time, everybody would say, yeah, lower taxes, you know, not just taking an extreme example. And they'd say, yeah, everybody, no more taxes or lower my taxes. But that can't be the way in which we run our government, because we do have an obligation to pay for certain services and programs that are essential in order to keep our society running. And so you can't just leave decisions up to the majority rule. And there are times when you actually have to balance things out. And that's the job of representational democracy.
To take a fuller and broader look and to be able to weigh all of those things, not just the interests of a particular group.
Yes.
All right. We've got callers on the line. I promise we'll move through everybody. If you're thinking about calling us, don't think anymore. Just call and we'll try to get you through. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Walt calling us from Kahala. Aloha, Walt. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to address a lot of those in private businesses. They are concerned, or who are opposed to SB1 in private businesses, are concerned that they will have to cater to couples or homosexuals, and they are afraid that it goes against their beliefs and say it impedes on their religious rights. Well, I say, isn't there a law that says if you deny them that already, based on their sexual orientation, that it's illegal for you to do that in the first place?
You're getting a whole bunch of heads nodding yes across the table here.
That's right. The Marriage Equality Bill doesn't change that. You're already obligated to, if you serve the public, if you hold yourself open to serve the public, then you're covered by the public accommodations law, and that prohibits discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation. There's no change to that.
Right, and if they say, oh, it impedes on their religious rights, well, what's to stop a Muslim business owner from denying, you know, their goods to someone who's Jewish based on a religious belief? You know, what's the difference?
Precisely. And the U.S. Supreme Court has held in more than one case that a state does not have to exempt people from generally applicable laws just because they claim that it violates their religious principles. That's very well established. You have an absolute right to your religious beliefs, but that doesn't mean you can do anything you want in the name of religion.
And
it would be chaos.
Under this new law, the SB1, it actually extends the protections for religious businesses and organizations by saying they have the right to refuse services in their renting out facilities or putting on, you know, a marriage or using their businesses, whether it be like a New Hope catering or something. They don't have to cater based on religion. So it actually extends their bias or prejudice towards.
Let's stop there and talk for just a moment. And thanks, Walt, for the call. Because, Carol, when you came in last week, one of the things we were talking about is this idea of right to refuse service, which really is not what this is all about.
Right. Although I think we should respond to what Walt just said. He's correct that the House has added an amendment. We don't know yet whether the Senate will go along with it, clarifying that a religious organization or nonprofit organization operated, supervised, or controlled by a religious organization shall not be required to provide good services, et cetera, for the solemnization or celebration of a marriage or civil union if it's in violation of their religious beliefs or faith. And
right.
I think he's correct that that's actually new in the sense that I don't think there was such an exemption in the civil unions bill. correct? So in that sense, the religious organizations are actually gaining a bit more of an exemption if they wish to withhold participation from celebrations or solemnizations. And that's why I said I don't think that the opponents of same-sex marriage should think that they were not heard, because I think legislators did try to accommodate them in that sense.
So they've actually gained a little bit more control.
Right.
This is different, though, from someone who is a provider of a wedding.
Correct.
Or helps to facilitate the wedding in some way, a baker or a wedding planner or something, who just says, you know, I'm sorry, I don't agree with you, and I'm not going to do that. It's a different situation.
That's correct. And when you and I spoke last week, we actually discussed the possibility of having some procedure where a person might be able to apply for a religious exemption, sort of along the lines where parents can apply for an exemption from the duty to produce their children for vaccinations, right? There is nothing akin to that in this bill, and I don't think we really need it. But that is something people could ask for, I suppose. But it would be a slippery slope because, as Walt points out, if you can ask for an exemption from the duty to provide services for a same-sex wedding, well, then presumably a florist should also be able to ask for an exemption from what would normally be a duty to provide florists for an interfaith wedding, right? Or an interracial wedding, or a wedding after a divorce if you don't approve of divorce. So it is a slippery slope, and I think people have to be very careful before you ask for that kind of thing, because it could have a way of tumbling into other areas of law.
Tonight we're talking about SB 1 and what could happen if this in fact becomes law. Depends in what form it becomes law, obviously. And we're looking through our crystal ball a little bit and taking a look at what would happen in the case that this becomes the rule of law, and how do we heal our community and create a future together as a community, and not just many factions pointing fingers at each other. 941-3689 is our number. If you're on Oahu, use that one. 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, 877-941-3689. Going to Arby calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Arby. Thanks for joining
Aloha.
Us. Go ahead.
Why do adults keep having to fight for fundamental rights in the United States of America? I think it's abhorrent, and it goes against everything that this country was founded upon, that adults are not treated like adults in every way, shape, or form, period, without interference from the state.
Arby, though, I mean, hang on a second, but just go back and look historically. I mean, you're saying the way it was founded, well, the way things were founded weren't so good for a whole bunch of people. Including women.
Let's recall George Mason of Gunston Hall, a Virginian, that put forth the Bill of Rights, which of course originally was a Virginia Bill of Rights, who would not sign the Constitution because it did not have a Bill of Rights. That's how much George Mason believed in the Bill of Rights. I think we all need to reflect on the Bill of Rights and really think about those who wish to stop others from having their fundamental rights as a U.S. citizen. What is it about those people that want others to not have their rights? And I'd like to leave it at that.
All right, Arby, thanks so much for the call. If you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I mean, you can hear the emotion behind a lot of our callers. It's really tough for some people to get their minds around this. Either way, it's a really difficult situation. So what do we do to start to move through some of this? I mean, we've talked a little earlier in the conversation about making space to be able to actually learn about what this actually means, to be able to disentangle ideas from real facts, really what does separation of church and state really mean, and to be able to understand that, you know, life continues, and it may be something that is top of mind now, but probably it's not going to be once things move along and life happens as it invariably does. But is there anything in all of that that you think is missing, Blake?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that I would point to is a lot of this we will have to rely on our religious leaders to actually talk to their congregations and actually try to clear up some of these misunderstandings. And in no way am I pointing the finger and saying, you know, they've inaccurately stirred things up. You know, people are very passionate. They're very emotional. And so once, if the bill does pass, and hopefully it does pass and we see what the final form is, then I think at that point it's incumbent upon them to actually really educate their congregation in terms of what does this really mean for us in terms of the future. We may have told you certain things in the beginning and said that we are opposed because of these fundamental reasons. But, you know, that may not change because that's just part of who we are and that's part of our religion. But how are we going to live in this modern society now that it is changing around us? And so it's incumbent, I think, upon the religious leaders to actually lead and to actually educate and to actually bring their congregations along to see that they can continue to have their religious freedom and exercise and do whatever they want to do privately. And their lives probably won't change one iota. And this actually won't really be undermining society and the pillars won't fall. And so how do we live forward in the society together, in this community together? Because we will be, because they'll be in your classrooms, they'll be in your businesses, they'll be in your workplace, they'll be in your neighborhoods. And so how do we do it together? And that, to me, is where the leaders have to come forward and start clearing up some of this misunderstanding.
Kind of why we're having these conversations, because there have been pieces of information which have been clearly false, that have been perpetuated in emails and in conversation and in comments. And that kind of stuff just isn't helpful.
Yeah, that's true. One of the bits of misinformation that I found particularly interesting was the number of testifiers who got up and said it's going to hurt Hawaii's tourist industry because people in Asia disapprove of gay relationships. And, you know, I taught law for 17 years in Hong Kong and I have published two articles about the gay rights movement in Hong Kong, and I can assure you it's very vibrant. And just last March, I gave a lecture in Chengdu at Sichuan University on the gay rights movement in Hong Kong. And the PhD student who organized the lecture for me said, I don't know how many students are going to come. And he got a room that would hold 30, and we had over 100 of mainland Chinese students sitting on the floor, crowding in, saying, we want to find out about what the Hong Kong gay rights movement has been able to do with the international human rights treaties that apply there, because we want more discussion of this here in our universities. And I just think, you know, those people who stereotype and say that, oh, same-sex couples are only a Western phenomena and you don't have that in Asia, it's not true. I can tell you this is an issue that's happening in Taiwan, Hong Kong, mainland China, all over Asia.
And the point that somehow it was anti-Hawaiian.
Anything but.
Right. I mean, some of these things, when you go back and you look and you dig up, it's just not true. Or what happens with children in situations? I mean, they're looking for emotional arguments that don't have facts behind them. And when you go looking for the facts, they just weren't there. We're going to go now to some of our callers who are there. Get them back in the conversation. Steve calling us from Pearl City. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the conversation. Great conversation so far. And I do have, you were alluding to a certain issue, but I'm not sure, I might have missed it, but you didn't quite cover it. There's a question about opening the door to polygamy. I do have a question because it does seem that if we want to redefine marriage in different ways, I'm not sure where the door starts to shut. I mean, if I walk down to the Board of Health and I apply for a marriage license with me and three of my fiancés, the government is going to discriminate against me to get married, obviously. So we do discriminate from our government, number one. Number two is that love is not a good enough reason at that point. I may love my three fiancés, and my three fiancés may love me. But people keep making this point about, well, if people love each other, they should be given the right to get married. And in a lot of ways, that's true. But there are some ways our government says, no, that can't be done.
All right. You want to hear what the panel has to say about
sure,
that? We touched this a little bit. Let's just go and give some quick answers just to bring him back up. Vanessa?
It's always a balancing test. And the issue that's in front of us is fairness and equality for same-gender couples who want to make a lifetime commitment. These are families that already exist in Hawaii who have been discriminated against far too long, and it's time to correct that. So that's the focus, that's front and center, and I think that is the obligation Hawaii lawmakers have to rectify.
But the issue is a one-to-one relationship.
Correct.
Not a one-to-many relationship, which seems to be, you know, more of the baggage that's being dragged in to look at this and saying, well, it's opening the door, exactly what Steve had to say. Carol, would you add anything to what Vanessa just said?
Well, in one sense, it's a good opportunity to talk about the difference between objecting to a marriage on religious grounds and objecting to a marriage on public policy grounds. When I was listening to the testimony, I kept waiting for some of the opponents to come forth with what I would call public policy objections, if they have any, and I usually didn't hear it. I generally heard it offends my religious belief. In contrast, if one looks at polygamy, there's a whole chapter in the gender and law book that I use for my students when I teach gender and law about some of the countries that have practiced polygamy. And I have to give the caller credit. He's right that it's not necessarily legal everywhere. In some places in customary law, polygamy is still legal. But there has been a lot of research on the harms that often result from polygamy. And one of it is that it almost always works to the disadvantage of women, because usually it's one man with several wives, and many of the wives wind up being disadvantaged or not cared for, or not getting their fair share of the marital assets. And so there's a lot of evidence of harm from polygamy, and I think that's why it certainly is within the realm of public policy. It's not just a religious objection. Similarly, child marriage, right? We have restrictions on child marriage. Not all cultures agree with the restrictions on child marriage. There are some places where the people really do think you can marry off your daughter at 8, 9 years old. But I think most of us would agree that there are public policy objections and objective reasons why you would want to prohibit it. I don't see that evidence in the case of same-sex marriage. I don't see the strong public policy arguments against it.
All right, let's move along, take some more calls. Dee calling us from Kailua. Aloha, Dee. Thanks for your patience.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to commend the panel and reinforce some of the statements that you made about the importance for our democracy of the separation of church and state. And this is an example of the art of having a democracy, is the inclusion of people that don't share the same beliefs or perspectives. And it's an opportunity for all of us to grow in that regard. I know that if we allow people just to refuse services or to discriminate against groups, it's like the pharmacist who refuses to fill a prescription for birth control. You know, that's not what a democracy is. And so I think it's important. It's another opportunity for us to grow as a country, to include all different kinds of people and to open up our hearts and minds to different perspectives. So,
Dee, thanks so much for your call.
So thank you.
Thanks for the call. Going now to Wayne calling us from Aiea. Aloha, Wayne.
Hello. Kind of directing this to Blake Oshiro. Hi, Blake. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious, since you were saying that it's kind of dependent on the religious leaders to mend some of the bridges that have been burned, considering that a majority of them use their leadership to brainwash most of their followers, who obviously aren't the most educated people, and from what I saw in testimony, were basically reading things that were pre-written for them, and a quarter of them were mostly children, and not the most educated people who were just reading a script and didn't even understand what they were saying. Where do you find the hope that these leaders are actually going to go back now and tell these people that it's acceptable to have two homosexuals getting married and living next door to them? And how do you find hope, and what do you hope that they're going to suddenly say this is all okay?
Wayne, thanks very much. And briefly, he's really asking you, how can you be so optimistic that somehow we'll be able to manage this?
You know, I look at this sort of personally in many ways. I think that what it really is an opportunity, I think, for religious leaders to look at what is the value of having two people in a lifelong committed relationship. And that, to me, is why the government actually recognizes marriage between two people and provides them certain benefits. Because as a society, we actually deem that there is a significant value in having two people committed to one another, two people caring for one another, being caretakers for one another for their lifetime, because that is something that overall will help and benefit our society. And so when I listen to that kind of message about what marriage is about, I think that is a real fundamental lesson that I don't think is in any way inconsistent with what I understand most religions to be, which is about acceptance, which is about finding a way and a path forward for yourself, but actually so that you can take care of those around you. And I think that kind of love, if we really get down to the fundamentals, is something that is definitely echoing throughout all of the religious teachings. And so for those people that had these objections, I think religious leaders need to go back to the basics and just say, that is really what we're talking about, is the ability for two people to love one another and care for one another so that they're not deemed to be a burden on somebody else, and so that they can actually take care of one another.
And that may take some while to do. That may not happen over years or a decade. It may be perhaps even a generation, because you're talking about going back and asking them to be very introspective and look at the way they've been teaching, what they've been teaching, and how they've been teaching, and what they fundamentally believe, and that may be unshakable.
It is, but I do still have the optimism that as over time goes along,
that love will prevail.
I do. I'm optimistic in that way.
Nice to hear some optimism. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I think even the new pope has indicated that, not that he's necessarily going to change his position, the Catholic Church's position on certain issues, but that the emphasis is perhaps under this pope's leadership going to change, to rather than always worrying about what people are doing that we don't think they should be doing, to rather worrying about how can the church be a positive force to address things like poverty and, you know, some of the real pressing issues of our time. So I think that there is room for religious leaders to address this issue in a way that strengthens the community eventually. It may take some time, though.
Well, the fact that the Pope could say something of the order of, well, you know, who am I to say or who am I to judge? That's not usually the kinds of statements that we're accustomed to hearing from a Pope, which is a different stance and has set him truly at odds with some in the Catholic Church. But that would support your idea that somehow this whole idea is shifting, that consciousness around the world is shifting. And when Justice Levinson was here, he was making the point that, look, this is not just about the United States. It's not just about North America, but this is about a worldwide shift in consciousness in countries, in places that you may not even think about. So to only myopically train your thought pattern to Hawaii or the United States or North America or the Western world is really not to take notice of what's really truly happening, that's being borne out by facts and where laws have actually been passed. Okay, moving on, going now to Kanoa calling us from Kailua. Thanks very much for your patience. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted your thoughts on the testimony of the Shopo president, Taneri Maafala. He said, quote, as a law enforcement officer, I will not enforce such laws and that we would have to kill him. I was wondering, from a legal standpoint, does that show that he holds prejudice against homosexuals? And by his testimony, can that be used against him as evidence that he holds a bias?
Interesting question. Who wants to take that one? Vanessa?
He has a right to his opinion, and I think because he exercised his right and expressed his view, there are others who are coming forward now to respond to that. And certainly when you are in a position of leadership like that, in a very visible position, one expects leaders to be more mindful of the statements that they make, especially coming from law enforcement. But he made a statement. He's holding himself responsible for it, so it's up to others now to respond to that. And I was glad to see that HPD came out and the chief made a statement about it. So I think that put it in better context
for the rest of
it. It was
a statement, though, from Chief Kailua. It wasn't saying, like, you know, anybody on my force who says that they're not going to enforce a law is going to have a problem with me. I mean, it wasn't that kind of a statement. It was, well, he was making his own statement as a private person. Still, And we talked about this on the morning show in the reality check, that it's kind of tough when you have somebody who has that kind of, you know, persona in our small place in the world who gets out there and says that. And it's like telling a jury, you know, disregard that last comment. You didn't really hear that part. He really was saying it as a private person. It's kind of tough for people to be able to disentangle the public from the private person.
Yeah, that's right. And I would just like to clarify one thing, though. I may have misheard him, but I did play it over twice. And I thought that he said, once I retire, I won't enforce these laws. And although I'm not saying his statement was a good one, it was, I think, very emotional, and I suspect someday he'll regret making it. But the impression I got is that he was saying, as long as I'm in this office, I will, of course, enforce all the laws that I'm obligated to enforce. But once I'm retired, I'm not going to enforce it. And I found myself wondering, well, actually, you're not involved in the administration of marriages, yeah. So you're not going to have that role. I'm not really sure that his threat, if it was a threat, actually amounts to anything. But on the other hand, it was a very unfortunate statement. And this is where I do think HPD should give a stronger response. I think HPD should be out there affirmatively reassuring the gay and lesbian community that they can count on police officers to treat them fairly. That's what made me nervous, is this expression of what I think a lot of people would interpret as homophobia. Maybe he didn't mean it that way, but it could easily create that impression. I think HPD should be reassuring the community.
That they will follow the rule of law, whatever the rule of law happens to be.
Well, not only follow the rule of law, but treat everyone fairly. And you know, sometimes police officers can follow the rule of law, but perhaps treat one minority a little differently than the other, a little more aggressive, a little less friendly, and that can have a really divisive, negative effect on a community. So I think it's important that HPD get out there and reassure people that HPD is not homophobic. That's the important point.
All right, let's go on and see what Carol, another Carol, has to say. Carol calling us from Kailua. Aloha.
Hi.
Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to the conversation, and it just brings to my mind a conversation I had this afternoon with a lady from, I'm a pastor of a small church in Kailua, and I was speaking with a lady who, it was quickly obvious to me that I'm a supporter, and she was an opponent of the whole law that's under discussion. And I was thinking that not enough has been made on their side of the issue about the whole thing about civil rights. I brought up to her that it wasn't really about religion, but it was a civil thing, that marriage was a civil act, and that people who couldn't get a legal marriage would not be entitled to get Social Security if one of the partners died and the other one was left without anything. And that was totally foreign to her. She had not heard it at all. And so I was just thinking that that might be a starting point for reconciliation, to look at it from the point of view of, you know, she has gay people in her family, but she just says, well, the Bible tells me, and this is what I have to believe. And I said, but did you ever think about, you know, their inheritance and things like that? And she was totally flabbergasted. She had never heard that.
You bring up a really good point, Carol, and thanks so much for the call, that the nuts and bolts part of this, what it means in actuality in life for people. I mean, we've heard of cases where we've had longtime gay or lesbian partners who find themselves in a situation where one of them is in hospital and, quote unquote, next of kin are called. And that this person has nothing to do with that. Now, I mean, truth, you can massage that a little bit through a civil union. There are other things you can do, but it's not the same thing that marriage partners take for granted that the rest of the family also acknowledges. That takes a little bit of doing, but still being able to not be left with utterly nothing, or having your home sold out from underneath you if it's in the name of one person and not the other. Some would say, well, that would take better planning. But you could say that of a lot of married couples, period. How do you protect the people who are in the most intimate of relationships with each other on a financial level, on a legal level? That's where some of the conversation has really not gone Blake?
Yeah, so what people generally don't understand is the state did provide as much benefits as it could with civil unions by giving all of the state benefits. However, what happens is there are over 1,000 federal benefits that just won't be afforded to the same couple if you don't have the word marriage as the way that your union is recognized.
Including Social Security.
Including Social Security and just a host of tax benefits and other things with inheritance and military benefits and Medicare. And so there's just a lot of things that you actually need to have that word attached to your relationship if you want to be afforded those benefits. And the state cannot do that unless it actually recognizes two people in a marriage. And that is one of the core things of the Windsor case that turned down the Defense of Marriage Act, is it said it is discrimination. And so federally, we're going to be able to recognize and give those benefits, but it's only going to be for same-sex for couples that are in a marriage. But the problem now we have is while the Department of Taxation in the federal government has said, yes, by a memo, everybody gets all the benefits, there are just a host of other benefits out there that departments have not made clear whether it's going to only apply if you're in a marriage of the state that recognizes it or if you're in a state that doesn't recognize your marriage. And so that is another legal problem that's created if your state doesn't recognize marriage.
Which is part of the argument why this is not going to stop on a state-by-state basis, that there may have to be federal law that covers all this so that there is no more discussion about it in terms of moving from state to state.
Right. Yes. But given the way our federal Congress is operating or not operating, I wouldn't count on the federal government to fix it.
So I think
it's wonderful that Hawaii is fixing it for its citizens. And I really commend the caller, Carol from Kailua, for reaching out and explaining that to this other woman, because I do think many other people don't understand it. And I would suggest that she might be able to lead some kind of movement. I think she said she was a pastor in a church. You know, perhaps she could contact other churches and help to explain this, because the financial benefits of being in a legal marriage are significant. And our church leaders always say that they care about children. And there are a lot of children in Hawaii who are living in difficult financial circumstances. It's a very expensive place to live. And therefore, it would be terrible if a child growing up in a same-sex civil union family is more poor or has fewer opportunities for education and other important essentials because they're not considered legally married by the federal government. So I think it's incumbent upon our state government, and I really commend the legislature for taking this issue on. It's promoting the economic well-being of the families of Hawaii.
But you all bring up a point in talking about Carol and what she did with talking to the other woman, that maybe this is going to have to happen on a person-to-person basis. I mean, you're all nodding at me. But the fact that it may not be you're going to go to a seminar and find out, or it's going to be done by a religious leader, but it may have to be somebody that you just simply like and trust who says, have you thought about it from this angle? Have you considered maybe that this might happen if these couple, you know, this couple were not able to be married? And who are the big winners and who are the big losers? You know, Carol Peterson, your point is that a lot of the big losers are going to be kids. I want to thank you all for being with us tonight. We're going to be watching and see how it plays out. The hour's gone, so we have to say goodbye. Unfortunately, not enough time. Thanks very much to Vanessa Chong, the Executive Director of the ACLU of Hawaii, to Blake Oshiro, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Abercrombie, and to Professor Carol Peterson, who teaches at the UH Law School and is also the director of the Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you right back here tomorrow morning for The Conversation. Have a good evening. Aloha.